Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Drive Talk Podcast.
We should have called it that.
The Drive Talk Podcast.
That would have been a brilliant idea.
Where did that come from?
I think you mean the Drive Talk Podcast.
That's the one.
Powered by Michelin.
Absolutely.
And we are still here at Car Vault Co. If you saw the last episode with Ben from Car Vault Co., if you haven't seen that, you need to head over. We talked all things classic cars, modern classics. And I think the best bit of that is we chose our classic cars, sub 25 grand, sub 50 grand, sub 100 grand, and then lottery win.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
And the even better part about that is Ped came up with some pretty good answers as well, which is very unusual, as I'm sure you're fully aware of.
So we're recording this here at Car Vault Co. and you guys watch and tune in, but you have the opportunity to come and watch us live because we're doing our first, well, actually, technically, our second live pod because we did that one at Caffeine and Machine.
We did.
But we're doing some live podcasts this year, but they are a little bit different in that they are only live once.
Yeah. So you'll come along and you'll watch and listen to us, ask us lots of questions off the record, essentially. Yeah, uncut.
Uncut.
I'm looking forward to it. And we're going to have, it's going to be at Bury BMW at Heathrow, so just inside the M25, on Friday the 15th of March.
Which is next Friday.
Yes. Oh, it is by the time this comes out.
This goes out, yeah.
We're going to have Mr. Tony Lewis, because Tony works at Bury BMW, and he's a brilliant guest. And it's just going to be brilliant. It'll be an evening event. There'll be food and snacks there. The link to the tickets, if there are still some, are below. If we've sold out, then unfortunately we have sold out. Unfortunately, we've sold out. But there will be more because we're definitely going to do more.
And we're going to bring them around the country. This is a first, if you like, a trial almost.
Yep.
But we're doing it by ticket just to control numbers, really, and just to cover costs. So there's a link below. Click on there. Hopefully there's be some tickets left and we shall see you for the Drive Talk Live.
Yeah. Can't wait.
That's going to be really cool. If you can't make it, or if the tickets have sold out, have no fear, because we will record a podcast that day that will go out onto the main podcast channel and all the audio platforms we use. But the live events, unless you're there, you won't get to see them.
Yeah. The Drive Talk Pedcast.
Pedcast.
That's
very cool. So what are we up to today? Well, if you follow either myself or Joe, you will know that we both have channel cars that have been through an interesting modification journey. And also, I think both my cars have modifications. You do it a lot. So we thought we'd have a chat on this podcast episode about modifying cars.
Yeah.
And try and cover, we won't be able to cover everything, I'm sure, but we'll cover all the main basic points, the things that you know, some of you may well be heavily into the modification scene, in which case we're probably not going to tell you anything new, but share our experience, and you might do that by putting a comment in the comments below. Some of you might have a car you think, I'd love to modify that, or think about it as an idea, but don't really know the pros and cons, the things to look out for, and that's what we thought we would do.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to start off with a question. Why on earth would you modify a car in the first place when car manufacturers spend millions of pounds in R&D to make the car as good as it can be, and then, you know, me or you or anyone goes and goes, oh, I can do better than that, and starts messing with it?
It's a good question. I think it's less of a relative question with a car that was built and manufactured, let's say, in 2024, because there's so many restrictions now with things like sound that mean cars like, let's say, my M3 don't sound that brilliant out of the box. Anything with an OPF filter, really. So we're talking about 2018 onwards. So I think there's little things like that. But yeah, as you say, it's an interesting question because cars should leave the factory as good as they can be, but that's not always the case.
And I guess the other thing you need to think about probably is the performance level of the car. So if you were buying something like a Porsche or an M car, then that's the top end of the performance level. You know, M car's been tweaked by BMW M. It's going to have lots of performance bits on it. If you're buying a car lower down in the range and you wanted to make its performance better, and that might be performance in terms of going faster, braking better, going around corners better, then that's when you might start to either put original bits on from that manufacturer that are just better than the stock ones you come on the car, or going to specific brake manufacturers, suspension manufacturers, and so on.
Yeah. I think there's, as you say, you always want your car to be slightly better, don't you? And whether that's aesthetic sort of modifications,
yeah,
that do sometimes cross over with performance.
Like stickers on the windscreen.
Or, yeah, stickers on the windscreen. You've got a number of driving certificates or qualified driving, sorry, distinction. Now, what are you?
I am Road Smart Masters distinction level.
Wow.
Thanks. Yeah. Yeah.
My goodness. Yeah. You know, the last podcast we talked about my mate Joel, who yeah. we all kind of sat there and went, he's cool.
Yeah.
He's a lot cooler than you.
oh.
yeah. So whether it's aesthetics or performance, I think there's the two, and they do obviously sometimes cross over. And you do get two different customers, if you like, that. Mm. That do just go to get their cars, make them look better, but then you do get ones that want outright pace, straight line, or better. Or then you've got the real track end side of performance as well. And you've got these different tuning houses that are now popping up everywhere that, you know, you and I use a lot of, that do specialize in each sort of area, I guess. So,
and yeah. I think that the aesthetics and performance, we could literally just, for now, have those as the two main areas.
Yep.
And the interest, I guess, the aesthetics one is a debatable one, because it's very much personal preference as to whether you think the car looks better after you've put, you know, a sunstrip on the top with, you know,
yeah, or red mud flaps.
Yeah, red yeah. mud flaps on a Mini Club, and that would be an amazing modification. Or, you know, speed stripes maybe, or yes. you know,
yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So you the aesthetics thing, and the other thing, I guess, some manufacturers or some brands of car, I think, lend themselves to that quite well. So I'm a Mini guy.
Yep.
There are so many companies out there, like my mate Sam at SMPS 2012, that sell bits to stick on your car, trim bits.
Yep.
Whether that's fake carbon fibery things, whether that's stickers and spot lamps and red mud flaps.
Does he do all those? The window frame trim stuff.
No, it's not that tasteless.
Oh,
no,
okay,
no, that's fine.
No, I wasn't sure because you could.
Oh, the dechrome stuff. Oh,
yeah.
You've got a dechrome. I mean, that's number one modification.
Yeah,
me. If I get a car that's, I don't know what it is about the obsession with modern day cars and chrome bits.
Yeah.
First of all, they're very rarely chrome nowadays because chrome. I don't know if you've ever been to a chroming factory, but it is the most terrifying place. I went when we filmed Vintage Voltage. I went to a chroming works, right. And there's these big vats of horrible chemicals, and they all basically want to kill you.
Okay,
yeah, not very nice at all.
No,
so yeah, so you could, dechroming, definitely.
Yes, you wouldn't dechrome that beautiful 3-litre CSL over there, though,
probably not. No, because that's got chrome back when chrome was a key part of the aesthetic.
Yes,
you know,
as part of the styling, 100%.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it would look pretty cool dechromed, but I wouldn't, because that's its. That's a proper classic car. But
it is.
If you look at that Mini over there,
yes,
with the chrome belt line and stuff, definitely.
Yes.
In fact, that's half dechromed and half not.
Yes.
That's got dechrome bits all over the radiators and stuff, but not on the door handles, which that just does my OCD in, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
So the aesthetic side of things, that's fair enough. And I think that's probably something that anyone could do at home.
Yep.
Like, I mean, even I put a belt line on at home.
Yep.
It's quite impressive skills, really. Let's talk about the performance modifications, though, because the question for me is, and I've had this in comments on videos and stuff around my cars. I've just done my Mini, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And on the collection video to that, loads of people said, how can you possibly make it better than BMW because they spend thousands of pounds in R&D? What's your thoughts on that? What the sort of performance enhancements? Because we thought we'd kind of have a chat, firstly, why you might do that. Can you make a car better? Because my gut feel says you can. But then we'll kind of walk through some of what those modifications might be, from simple things you can do that make a big difference to big things that you do that might make very little difference and you end up having to reverse.
Yeah, it's an interesting, it's a bit of a, Yeah, I wouldn't say. It's like how long's a piece of string in many ways, isn't it? And I think you can definitely make majority of cars better, even supercars. You know, a lot of, like, let's use an R8, for example, it's an everyday friendly supercar. They're designed to be very user-friendly, even in quattro form, i.e., you know, we all joke about, or I maybe do, about Audi steering, but they're set up to understeer a bit as opposed to oversteer, because oversteer kills, and the average punter that's going to jump in 150 grand R8 might not have the talent that it needs to tame that car. So these manufacturers, they dial in things like understeer, and their test drivers and their years of development, they make them, they tame them, dumb them down almost, so that if you did use that car and you were a capable driver, you use it on track and stuff, you can adjust things buying stuff online aftermarket that will improve it. And I think with your Minis, or my BMWs, although BMW M put so much research and development into these cars to make them as good as they could possibly be for that price point, there is then a better version of whatever it is that you've got. It doesn't matter how good or how expensive your M4 CSL was, you could still improve on that car because BMW M had a budget. They couldn't, you know, it wasn't endless. There's always better suspension, KW, Bilstein, and there's all these aftermarket suspension brands that are building suspension setups that are three or four times more than BMW could have spent at the time, you know? Yeah. So things like that. And also with engines, they're all so safe. Like the S58, which is in the M2, M3, M4 nowadays, I know for a fact, so out of the factory, 510 horsepower, but the Red Bull Drift Brothers, who I'm seeing in a few weeks, actually, a MotoGP race, they run M4 drift cars up to 1,200-1,300 horsepower. And BMW M categorically told them that the base, the block of the of that S58 is good for 1,300 horsepower. not wow. saying the piston rings or, you know, there's a lot of things.
What
you
about
need
the crank
to,
pulley, is that?
The crank hub, yeah. Well, I think they fixed it on the S68, a 58 rather. But so there's definitely, I mean, I'm sure even BMW M off the record would say, well, of course we can get more performance out of this car. But three things: cost, warranty, and longevity. You know, they don't want their cars blowing up in 3 or 4 years, even when they are out of warranty. They don't want these headaches, these issues to be, you know, remembered about. So, yeah, I think in my head that's what it is. In most cases, there is a little bit of movement in some cases. But you've got to pick and choose, and you've got to be careful with things like warranty. And I mean, that's a whole different.
Yeah, we'll maybe touch on warranty and insurance a bit later on. We've talked about some of the different options you've got. So should we do that? Should we step through some of the things you can do? And I wanted to start at a place that most people might not even consider to be a modification.
Yep.
But for me, it's a really easy way to get performance gains.
Yep.
Often without spending a great deal of money.
without a pillow.
Yeah, put a pillow in the back. And then if you're tired, first things first, without putting anything new on your car, you can just run the correct tire pressures in the car. And that the amount of people you see driving around with tires you can see are underinflated.
Yeah, or overinflated.
Yeah, yeah. It does terrible things for your economy, but handling, tire wear, general performance. So if you look at whatever the recommended tire pressures are for that car, and check your tire pressures every week.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of cars will have tire pressure monitoring systems, but I think that makes people really lazy.
Yep. They're not massively accurate.
They're not very accurate. And often they probably don't do anything unless there's maybe a 2, 3, 4% or a 4 PSI change in the pressure before it lets you know. And by that time, you've probably been driving around with an underinflated tire for a while.
Yep.
And you'll get better performance. You'll get a better ride. You'll get better tire wear.
Yep.
So if you underinflate your tires, you're gonna wear down the outside rim, and if you overinflate them, you're gonna wear down the middle bit. So, so that's something super simple.
And connected to that, it's not free, but it's not a massive expense. Is setting up the geo of the car, because even new cars, they all come out, as we talked about with that R8, they all come out with a very safe setting, but they've all got tolerances to leave the factory. They can't come out of the factory, you know, sort of crabbing. But you'll be surprised at how much movement there is in those tolerances. Yeah. And the tolerances can't be too fine because it just couldn't happen on a production line. So a lot of the cars I've had a lot of new cars over the last 5-6 years, and they're all, when you put them on a measuring tool, you look at them, they are horrifically out,
yeah.
But they're still mostly within the parameters.
Yeah.
So you get a good geo done, and it like the pressures, geo transforms the car.
And just worth probably saying that there's tracking.
Yep.
And there's wheel alignment.
Yes.
And they're very different things.
Yep.
So some of the lower end, cheaper tire replacement places, they'll balance the wheels when they put the new tire on, and then they'll say, do you want your tracking done? And tracking normally just looks at the front wheels, right?
Yep.
So what you really want to do is spend probably another 40 or 50 quid, maybe as much as 100 quid in total, depending on where you go, and get a full wheel alignment,
yep.
Where they put it on a jig. And you can do that with lasers, or if you really want to go old school, you can do it with string.
Yep, yep.
I mean, if you've got a performance car,
yep.
If you go to someone who knows what they're doing with string,
yep.
then you'll get the car set up beautifully.
Yep.
And they can actually then ask you what kind of characteristics you want in your car.
Yep.
You know, do you want it to be a little bit sharper on the front, a little bit more more communicative? And they'll dial some of those things out.
Yeah, are you using it, providing you've got all that adjustment, so let's say top mount, adjustable top mounts and stuff. And like you said, you can tailor the car to my M2 when I'm using it on the road mostly. If I had the ability to change my setup all the time, when it's on the road, it's going to be dialed in with a lot less aggressive sort of camber and stuff because I'm going to be loading it up less. And also I want it to handle nicer and calmer on the road. And when I'm on track, I want it to be more aggressive because I'm pushing it hard. But as with all these things, and I'm sure we're going to talk about this soon, when you start adjusting the geo to a more aggressive setup, it's less friendly on the road,
yeah.
And vice versa. And that kind of is the rule with most aftermarket tuning, let's say.
Yeah.
The more hardcore your car is, the faster it is, the more capable it is. Sometimes the less chilled and relaxed and easier it is to live with. Yeah. As I know you've discovered recently, yeah. with your Mini.
But let's face it, most road cars are going to be set up as a compromise.
Yeah.
So kind of, you know, jack of all trades, really.
Yeah.
Was it Suspension Secrets that did your...
Yeah, Suspension...
A couple of years ago now. When
yeah, you, they've... So Matt, Suspension Secrets, he uses strings. But then more recently, I've been using Russ at Swift, and they use lasers and stuff.
Yeah.
But
Aaron did set mine up with string, I think.
Yes.
My Mini.
Yeah, yeah. Like you said, I think if they really know what they're doing with string, and it's amazing to watch.
The first time I did that, I was racing a Clio, and there was a guy set a string set up in the paddock, and I have no idea what he was. I said, what is that guy doing with all that string? And you know, and the guy running it, he went, that's setting the car up, mate.
Yeah, like,
but it's string.
Yeah,
where's the lasers? He went,
no. Yeah.
That's, and then you read into it, it's amazing, really.
Yeah.
So yeah, good geometry, good tire pressures.
Yeah.
And then I mean the. When I bought my Mini, the best modification, I did two amazing modifications to my Mini, but the first one I did actually in this order was it came with run flat tires.
Run crap.
Honestly.
Yeah.
So.
You can understand the thing with run flat
why.
Is. Yeah, yeah, that's a problem. If it's your daily and you and your partner are using it, you can kind of understand it.
And
but
you have a puncture, you can drive home. Yeah. You don't need a spare tire. So I guess, you know, the cynic in me would say it's saving the manufacturer the cost of a spare wheel and tire.
Yep.
It's saving them the packaging of physically having to be able to put one of those in the car somewhere.
Yep.
So a car comes with run flat tires. The ride quality and the handling characteristics of that car are always going to be worse than a normal road tire.
Yeah.
Because of the way, you know, they've got a very stiff sidewall that can basically sustain itself even if there's no air in the tire.
Yep.
And they're just generally horrible things. So if you are into driving and want a better feeling car and stuff, get rid of your run flats and put a decent set of premium tires on it.
Yeah.
Now we're sponsored by Michelin, we're bound to say, you know, put Michelin tires on it, but just don't go cheap. I still amazes me. I'm in a Porsche forum, and there's every now and again someone found these amazing tyres for my 911, right? It was a 992, £100 a corner, right? I'm going to use them for track days. They're amazing.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No, they're ditch finders.
Yeah.
So you think you've got like a premium sports car. There's four bits of material stick you to the road.
Yep.
And people buy the cheapest, crappiest tyres they can.
Yeah.
I just don't understand it at all.
It doesn't make any sense, does it?
You would be better off spending a couple of grand less on the car.
Yep.
And putting that money in the bank and using it for tyres for the next couple of years.
Yep. And it is the best. Something else to touch upon with, like you said, with the Run Flats, the amount of people, and as you say, we are both now Michelin brand ambassadors. This podcast is sponsored by Michelin. So without sounding too much like a Michelin fanboy or salesperson, when the amount of BMWs these days that come on, I'm not going to name the name of the tyre, but whatever it might be, Run Flats or whatever, some other climates actually, like in the UK, for instance, M340Is, M440Is, a lot of the M lights, they all come with another brand, Run Flat tyre. Whereas you go to Australia and all those models come with Michelin PS4Ss. And guess what? The Australian cars feel so much better. And I think in the UK, our biggest problem over here is the road surface and the quality of the road and the quality of a ride, therefore. And you put on a good set of tyres like PS4Ss or whatever, and it irons out those little ripples. It just takes that away because of the way the sidewall and the tread is constructed. And that, therefore, then makes not just a difference to the ride quality, it also makes a difference to how the car handles because it's not any longer skipping across the surface of the road like micro skips. It's now working with the surface.
Yep.
And that makes a huge difference, especially this time of year when they're a bit greasy and slippery. You're finding grip that you just didn't know was there with your last sort of Run Flat tyres or whatever. So, yeah, I'm not going to...
And I know people go, yeah, but what happens if you have a puncture? Well, you can have an emergency kind of gunk.
Yep.
But they only generally work if it's gone down while it's stationary. If you have a tyre deflation and you're moving, by the time you stop, you've normally done so much damage to the sidewall.
Yeah.
Then an even gunk's not going to get you out of it.
No.
And you end up having to call an emergency breakdown cover.
Yeah.
But I've got any wood I can touch around here. Nowadays, you don't get that many punctures.
No.
It doesn't happen that often. Maybe every, whatever, So, yeah, you do run that risk of being stuck by the side of the road.
Yeah.
And for some people, that risk is unacceptable. For me, it's all the days of driving in between each of those punctures.
Yep.
You get a better driving experience.
Yep.
Like one day is going to be a bad day.
Yes.
But,
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's for me the simple things.
Yeah.
You don't and then just the final thing is just keep your car serviced. Change the oil regularly.
Yeah.
Change the fluids regularly and look after it and maintain it. And I know sometimes my Porsche is going it's next week and the week after this podcast goes out. And it's a major service. And I know it's gonna be £1,400, I think.
Wow.
And that's a lot of money. But it's a Porsche for a start, so you don't buy a car like that without expecting a big bill every now and again. And I know that, it's you need to do that whenever the service interval comes in, you take your car for a service.
Yeah. Yep.
So that's number one.
Yes.
You might not think of that as modification, but
no, but it's the basics.
It's your cheap performance gain, right?
Yeah.
The cheapest way of getting performance gain is just,
yep,
put some decent tires.
Well, if you had budget tires that were badly worn with a terrible geo setup with different pressures, that would be a massive upgrade if you change those three things. Depending on how your car is, really. But anyway,
next one I've got on my list, I've got an agenda this week.
Trying
to get us some the next one is, and I think this is a personal preference thing, but I know it's a subject very close to your heart because I've heard you talk about it a lot on videos, and a lot of it's got to do with regulation, and that is a modern day car. There are regulations about how the wheel and tire package sits in the arches.
Mm-hmm.
And what it generally means is when a modern day car comes out, the wheels look a little bit small and they generally look like they're tucked up into the arches. And you've normally got quite a big gap between the top of the tire and the bottom of the arch.
Yep.
And a modification I know you've done, you do to pretty much every one of your cars. I've got it on my Mini although I haven't done it on my Porsche because it just happens to sit really nicely, is to think about lowering the stance of the car. I just call it, if you like, stance.
Yep.
Changing the stance of the car. So you could lower the height, ride height of the car with something like lowering springs.
Yep.
You could either change the wheel design so the offset's a bit different, so the wheels stick out the arches a bit, or put some spacers to push the wheels out. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, I've used a lot of spacers in a lot of my cars over the years. If you're using the standard wheels, then that's kind of the only way you can do it in terms of getting the wheels out. With spacers, never go crazy, not just because of in terms of rubbing, but you got to remember, the bigger your spacer, the more stress you're putting everything else under, because it's a leverage bar, really, isn't it? So thin spacers, subtle spacers, and most importantly, any spacers, whether it's a 4mm, a 6mm, 8, 10, 12, get them, make sure they come with extended wheel bolts. I mean, that's a really dangerous, that's what gives spacers, most spacers, their bad reputation is, cheap spacers will break, but on top of that, you need the wheel bolts, because if you don't extend your wheel bolts, and you obviously then you're hanging on by a few threads, and that is not, that's not good. I think, like you said, modern cars are really crying out for spacers, and that's why on cars like many BMWs, you'll see these funny, they look like aftermarket little plastic wheel guards, usually arch guards on the, you usually find them on the rear.
They stick out a little bit, yeah.
They stick out a little bit, and all that is to do is to cheat the regulation, so that when you measure that, where your wheel is in comparison to the furthest part of the wheel arch, obviously that reduces how far the wheel has to go inside the arch, which is, I mean, it's not rocket science, and you can easily take them off. I take them off on my M3 because they just look, I don't think they look great. But yeah, so that's one way. Say my Edelweiss wheels that are on my M3, they are, the fitment on them is designed for that specific car, and they fit perfectly. And they are exactly how the wheels should have looked if BMW or BMW M were allowed to do that. There's no denying they would, you know, you want as wide axle as possible, so there's not rubbing on the wheel arch. In terms of like handling and stuff, you get a slightly bigger footprint. They look good. So you got the aesthetics. You definitely got a tiny bit of improvement in handling. And then the lowering springs. I mean, I've gone too far with them. I know you can get really low stances, which maybe might appeal for some people, but we've already talked about our UK roads.
Yeah.
They're not great. Then you've got speed bumps, all the rest of it. If you go too far down, you learn very quickly when you've smashed your splitter off or you've hit your sump. Or, so I think, again, it's all about subtlety with the M3s, especially. They seem to sit quite high at the front. So I just run the I-back spring, which just drops it about 15 mil. So the whole car just looks square. Then the rears are standard. Whole car looks good. But again, you can go crazy if you're like into your show cars or your people run airbags, don't they?
Well, bags are, I kind of get that because they look quite, when the car's parked, it looks like its coils are broken.
Yes.
What's the one where the wheels are like in like that? Is it camber? The really,
yes.
You know the ones that look like the wheels have, like the axle's broken?
Massive negative cam, yeah.
What's that about?
That's
whoever thinks that looks anything, or where you get a car, it's got tiny wheels.
Yes,
but when you get a car that's set up and it's got a really nice stance, I think it's one of those, if you know, you know. I think there are some people won't even see that, but the car community thing, I think when you have a car that sits nicely, then it just, you can see it from miles away.
You can.
And it's a trick to get it right. I'm so pleased with the way my Mini sits now, and that's got spacers on it, and it's got adjustable ride height on the Bilstein. But it's not. We've not gone too daft. I had a bit of rake on it before. We've raised the nose a little bit because the front was a bit low, and it just looks really, really nice.
Yeah.
My Porsche, I've not done anything to that because it's a GTS, so it sits 20 mil lower anyway.
Yeah.
It's just perfect from factory.
Yeah.
So there's an example. You think, well, there's no point changing that. No. Like, oh, you're going to change the suspension? No, it's perfect.
Yeah.
It's a Porsche.
Yeah.
You know,
I think it really is one of the brands that is maybe an exception, isn't it?
Yeah.
But saying that, there's such, the great thing with the Porsches is they've got such little overhangs and stuff. So if you did drop them a little bit, you're not, unlike other supercars or sports cars, they're still very user-friendly, aren't they? I mean, I feel like both of us blow smoke up Porsche's arse all the time.
Yeah, it's because there's a lot of smoke to blow.
There is a lot really of smoke. Big arse. Literally, it's just...
The only thing I've done on mine is, you mentioned about OPFs and noise, is I put a Miltech OPF back exhaust, which we'll come on to a bit later, but I can't see the reason to do anything else to my Porsche.
Yeah.
Whereas my Mini,
different
story completely.
Yeah. Outwise, out of warranty. It's a bit like my M2.
Yeah, the second it was out of warranty, it's like, right, whoo, let's go.
Yeah.
We'll come to warranty in a bit as well.
Yes.
So that's stance, right? So next thing, and actually, well, we're just talking about the Mini. I often get asked, because I've done quite a few things to the Mini, people say, what's the best modification you've done to the Mini?
Yep.
My answer, apart from taking it off run flats and putting on decent tyres, is, and I did this after I'd done all the power modifications.
Yep.
I then put a limited slip diff on it.
Yes.
And
because it doesn't come with one.
No.
Does it?
No.
Okay.
Not from factory. So
what? Which Minis did of that era? Did any of them? Like John Cooper Works hatch or anything?
The Challenge 210.
Challenge 210. Oh, that's
I think.
Cool. Yep.
I don't even think the GP did.
Yep.
If you're a Mini person, you probably, but I don't. So things like, I guess, modern day front wheel drive, because limited slip diffs, you can use a front wheel or rear-wheel drive. But if you've got a powerful front wheel drive car with an open diff, then you're straight away wet conditions, tight corners, you're losing power because one of the wheels will spin up.
Yeah.
But if you think about things like Fiesta ST, you can spec that with a limited slip diff, i20N from Hyundai.
Yep.
Brilliant cars. And it makes such a big difference.
Yeah.
So I think even if I just put a limited slip diff, I've got a Quaife ATB in my Mini, before I'd done any power modifications, I think it would have been a better car to drive, and you can access the power that's there before you even think about adding some.
Yep.
The downside of putting a limited slip diff in a car is cost.
Yeah.
Front wheel drive car, that pretty much means you've got to take the engine out or split the engine and gearbox, because the diff sits by the clutch in between the engine and gearbox.
Yeah.
So it's the diff itself, I think, remember now, I think it was like £500, £600.
Yeah.
So it's not a ridiculous amount of money, but putting it in the car.
Yeah.
It's probably that as well.
Yeah.
That
again.
So, so it's not a cheap modification.
Yeah.
But the performance benefits it gives you are massive. So you can then make the most of the power you've got.
Yep.
And then when you start, if you start going through the increasing the power journey, you've already got the diff in the car to help make the most of any power you add.
Yep.
So I'd, for a front wheel drive car, certainly a little hot hatch, a diff is a brilliant place to start.
Yep.
And if, I don't know, sometimes you do modifications because the car's in pieces, because you might have misshifted and blown the engine up or something. And at that point, you can make decisions about putting stuff in, can't you, Joe?
Yeah. Thankfully, never happened.
No.
Oh, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. But if you, let's say, for example, you need to put a new clutch in a car.
Yes.
So the gearbox has got to come off anyway to put the clutch in. So at that point, all the labor's done because the bits are apart anyway.
Yeah.
So it's a relatively cost-effective time to say, can you put a limited slip diff in the car?
Yep.
Maybe.
Yep.
Diff was a game changer for my car.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's a very, not undervalued, but underappreciated part.
Mm.
Everyone knows in here's limited slip diff. And in fact, the M1, when the early M135i's came out, the probably biggest complaint from a lot of people in the winter was, oh, it's got an open diff. And then the M140 came out with a lot more torque. It was like, oh, it's got an open diff. In the summer months, they came on Michelin Pilot Supersports. They were great, and they almost didn't feel like they needed a diff because 330 horsepower, whatever, it just about dealt with it. Winter months, different story. But when you tracked it and really pushed it, and my M140, the last one I had, the mineral gray one, we put a diff in that. And huge difference. Not a huge difference in terms of like outright lap time or something, maybe a couple of tenths here and there out of the slower hairpins, but just it, unlike a front, because I think if, like you said, the front wheel drive car really benefits from it in terms of outright traction, but it just made the whole car much more predictable and smoother. And when the tail felt like it was going to come out, it was a much more manageable, controlled slide, or not even a slide. It would just, you'd feel it initially lose. You'd be like, okay, well, we've run out of grip now. But then the diff would start working and fire you forwards, as opposed to just the open diff. You wouldn't know what was going to happen sometimes, you know. Sometimes you'd get a big angle, other times it would just snap. So it just gives you that much nicer sort of, more understandable drive, sure-footedness, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't suddenly give you a four-wheel drive amount of grip, because that's impossible. You still only got your rear wheels, but it manages its traction on that rear axle much better and in a much smoother way than an open diff would.
Yeah.
So it's a great, but again, even though you don't have the whole gearbox thing, it is still relatively, if you can't do it yourself, you know, there's still a bit of labor involved and stuff, but yeah, an open diff on anything with more than about 250 horsepower rear wheel drive is definitely,
It's just one of the things that, you know, you almost get your housekeeping in order before you start adding power. Because I think most people's like, power,
yes.
I'm just going to start putting a billion horsepower in the car.
Yep.
If you sort out the basics first,
yep.
You know, and you sort out your wheel and tire package, and then you sort out your traction, and then you start adding power after that, maybe.
Yes.
And then closely coupled with that, if you're going to add power, you want to add braking as well. We'll come to that in a minute,
yes.
I suppose.
Yeah.
So that was my next on my list of stuff was traction. So brakes. We're going to leave power for a bit.
Yep.
Now, I guess modern day cars, especially, their brakes are. Compared with 20 years ago, they're amazing.
Much better, yeah.
Even a low end, you know, budgety type car, the brakes are pretty good.
Yeah, well, they weigh so much these days, so they have to be pretty good.
I know, yeah. Although we were joking, there's a Maybach in the corner over there. It's got two sets of calipers on the front. It's that big.
The whole front wheel is just calipers.
I've never seen that before. So brakes, an interesting one, because again, you want to make car go faster. Whether that's round a corner through better handling, or whether that's just out and out power, but at the end of the day, you know, you want to be able to stop as well. And one of my favourite things, I think we talked about this when we were at the Porsche Experience Centre, is I remember being with Porsche a long time ago now, and they said that one of their design briefs is whatever the 0-62 time of a Porsche is,
yep.
The 62-0 time has to be half.
Wow. Which, when you look at something like that 991.2 Turbo S over there, that's scary.
It's amazing.
Yeah, that's...
So, you know, you've got to stop. So when you want to start modifying brakes, and we've both been there, but I've just been through the back end of this journey, is, I guess, the first thing you can do probably the most cost-effective thing you can do is maybe just change the pad.
Yep.
So if you've got the standard disc... And caliper that the car came in, but just get a slightly different compound of pad,
yep.
From somebody like Mintex or somebody like that.
Yep.
There's maybe just a little bit more performance oriented, and it'll give you a bit more bite.
Yep.
It might give you more disc wear, so you might end up having to change your discs more often.
Yep.
Because that was the thing back in the day, discs lasted like 80,000-90,000 miles, and you just changed the pads.
Yeah.
And then ABS came in. And the pad, the discs are so soft, you end up having to change your discs after like 30,000 miles or something.
Yeah.
So you could change your pad.
Pad and fluid.
And brake fluid. Yeah, of course.
Putting good fluid in there.
And even maybe lines, just do a braided hose on a standard caliper.
Especially, the last bit of the line that heats up the most near the caliper. That sort of thing. Also, if it's a really old car, just looking at what we talked about earlier on, maintaining... like brake ducts. If it's a sportier car and it's got brake ducts, they might be full of rubbish.
Yeah.
So just make sure they're clear and clean, because the heat, when your brakes get too hot, especially on track, heat is what kills everything. It kills the pads, kills everything. So
boils the fluid. Yeah.
Boils everything, yeah. And also that heat dissipates into your tyres, which are already running at their limit. So all of a sudden you've got, that whole wheel is just, everything's over temperature.
Funny because I slightly off topic, but on topic, you see what I mean? I got asked by someone online this week. They'd bought a car and they were going to start doing their first track days.
Yep.
And they basically asked what they should do before they take their car on track. And I'm not an expert in this by any means, but my advice was fairly basic stuff. check your tire pressures, check your tire treads and the quality of your tires, check your brake discs and so on. And then, but I said the most important thing when you're on track is make sure you only go out for like, I don't know, 4 or 5 laps. Come in, always have a cool down lap, and then and make sure you let your, not just your engine, but your brakes cool down.
Yep.
And when you park up, don't put your handbrake on.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Just leave it in gear, put it in park. And just those little things. But brakes, yeah, you put your handbrake on in a track day, you're basically asking for trouble.
Yeah. Yeah, well, a lot of cars with electronic handbrake, sometimes there's no way, sometimes they'll just turn on automatically, right? Yeah. But yeah, I think that's one of the best bits of advice for track day stuff is just don't go it's so hard. I haven't been on track now.
Open pit lane ones are worse because you can just keep going out.
And it's so hard because you're there for the day, you've got your car, you've paid your insurance, maybe you haven't, I don't know. You know, it's an expensive day already, so you want to maximise your day. It's great you're there because you love track work and you see your mates out or other people. I've got to get out. And I've done loads of track days, but I'm still, and it's like, no, come in, cool things down, because then guess what, at 4 p.m when everyone else has cooked their cars and they're on the trailers or they're driving home, you're there then left on a track with nobody there because, yeah. And you've still got fuel, you've still got brake pads, you've still got tires. That's the best time of the day, is at the end of the day when you're, because everyone does, you know, cars break down, people go home early. The last hour of a track day is always the best. Yeah. But yeah, maintain, keep those temperatures down, and you have more fun.
Yeah. So the brake thing's an interesting one. So I'd done all my modification on my Mini and I thought, right, I remember you drove it round Goodwood. And
yes.
The brakes were shocking.
Yes.
Because they were literally just about to die. The pads were down, the discs were worn and ready to go.
Yep.
And it wasn't really, the brake pedal wasn't doing a great deal, was it?
No. Not at all. I thought my big clumsy feet were hitting the clutch.
I know. So I thought, right, I'm going to put some big brakes on it. Now, the challenge with big brake kits or race brakes is I learned this when I went to Alcon, because I worked with Alcon and I got an amazing set of Alcon brakes. And, you know, you talk to those guys about brake design and it's amazing how much work the manufacturers or specialist brake manufacturers have to put in for road car brakes.
Yep.
To be able to perform. But there's a whole bunch of things that sit under the banner of NVH, noise, vibration and harshness.
Yep.
Basically means, do they make a noise and squeal and all that kind of stuff. And it's very difficult to make brakes that don't squeal. So to make them not squeal, by the very fact of doing that, you take away a bit of their outright performance. So road brakes and race brakes, apart from the fact one will, you know, operate at higher temperatures and stop you better, the race ones, they generally, the race brakes, don't care about noise, vibration and harshness.
No.
So their only interest is stop the car as fast as you can.
Yep.
And therefore, when you are upgrading your brake package on a car, the temptation is to get the biggest, raciest, megarest brakes you can.
Most powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's great if you're on a track. But as soon as you want to use that car away from a track on a day-to-day basis, they generally are quite tiresome.
Yeah.
Because they'll squeal all the time.
Yep.
And they'll be quite grabby, quite severe when you do push on the brake.
Yep.
They'll stop you. And that's the mistake that I made. And I'm sure a lot of people made.
Yeah, well, it's, like you said, I think brakes are the really difficult one to get right. And there is no right, really. Because I think, as with anything modifying, if you're talking about track stuff, I remember talking to Russ from Swift when I was doing my M2, and it was like, right, so I want to turn this road car into a really good track car, but one that I can use on the road and have fun too. And it was just like, there's not really, you either go track or road. And there is an in-between, but there's not. And I think with things like brakes, like you said, I went down the AP route, which cost me a small fortune. Even the pads, I think there are RS29s I run in the M2. I think the front set of pads are about £600.
Wow. I got RS... Padgetts?
Yeah, Padgetts.
Yeah, yeah. The first pads I put on the Alcons, they were, for the Mini, they were £350 a pad.
Yeah. They're just crazy, aren't they? I mean, they work really well. But then, yes, straight away, you're losing all of the everydayness of them. Even down to, like, the floating calipers. So we had to put, like, special... Because if you get a AP caliper, and I'm sure it's the same with the Alcons, due to the maximum heat
dissipation
You'd get that. They're floating, right? A lot of road car calipers are floating as well, but they're not physically floating like Alcons or APs. And so if you put them on and you drive along, the whole disc goes dunk, da-dunk, da-dunk as you drive forward. It's fine at fast speeds because the centrifugal forces keep it. But when you're cruising through your town and stopping at central traffic lights, it literally sounds like you've got no wheel bearings left. And so then you end up putting, they sell like shims or whatever that basically stop the disc moving. But obviously then you lose some of that performance. But yeah, you can go way too far. And I think my brakes of my current car, they don't annoy me because in my head it's like, this is a race car. but
has Lou driven it on the road?
In the current driving position, she can't drive it because the seat's too low. And Lou's Lou's 5'9", 5'9 and a half. But things like the brakes, they're very grabby. They're a bit too much. But I even found that I had an RS7 Performance recently that had the carbon ceramics out of the Audi factory, and I hadn't driven an RS Audi with carbon ceramics on it for a long time, and I found that this particular press car had 10,000 miles on the clock, so properly used, and I found those brakes, even after a week of having that car, I found them, it was one of my negatives in my review, don't spend £9,000 on the brakes because they're too aggressive for on the road. Even after a week just touching the brake, they felt like they're going to throw you through the windscreen. And that's great. I'm sure if I took it out on track and absolutely kicked its head in, but on the road, stopping for a set of traffic lights from 40 miles an hour, it was really tricky. So I think, yeah, brakes is a really fine balance, and you can fine-tune things with different pads. But basically, the better a brake is, the worse it is for the road almost.
Yeah, pretty much.
But you found a good compromise.
Yeah, so now I've got the discs, they're vented. And they've got some scoring on them because my Alcons had quite big scores on them that made a noise when you braked hard. It was like,
yep.
When you broke hard, it was very off-putting, but they're just doing their job.
Yes.
And just an upgraded set of pads. And I'm not going to really track that car so much, and it's fine.
Yeah.
When I picked them up, I was like, these are the best brakes ever. And then the track date, they're amazing. And then I thought, it's squeaking a bit. It's squeaking. Race car brakes, it's cool. And then Tracy took it out.
I was going to say.
The shops and came back. She went, what have you done to that car? You've destroyed that car. It's horrible. I'm never driving it ever again. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
I've gone too far with the brakes. Oh.
Yes.
But in all seriousness, if you are going to add to the performance of the car, then you do need to have a look at the braking capabilities.
Again, there's nothing more frustrating. I'll go back to Goodwood in 2022 and I had an M240i press car. It's actually when I got my racing license, you came down that day.
And you've got your racing license as well.
I do have it, but I don't have a sticker on my windscreen saying I've got it.
Okay.
I'm not sure if that's official.
Yeah.
But you came down to Goodwood. So M240i, Michelin had insured it because it was a Michelin thing. And so I thought, I've got to go and do some hot laps in it. It's a capable little car. First half lap. And I was like, this thing is awesome, like really good. By the end of the first lap at Goodwood, so after that last, what's the long braking into the shell? Into there, the brake pedal suddenly became really long.
It's only like four braking efforts.
Exactly. No, honestly, mate. And then
the first one, if it was the first lap, you don't really brake into the battery because you're not going fast enough.
Exactly, yeah. So literally three or four hard brakes. It was quite a warm day. And that was it, game over. And the second lap, it was just like... And there is nothing more frustrating than a car that, forget a slow car is fine because you can make a slow car faster over a lap by doing whatever. But a car that can't stop or doesn't feel like it wants to stop is a horrifying experience, especially the faster it is, the more horrifying it is. So that M240 is a punchy little car. But after two or three laps, I was like, I don't have any confidence in these brakes. I feel scared. And that's it. So that was it. It was day over, really. And for me, anyway, it was like, I'm not having any fun in this car because it ruins it. Did I want more power? No. More hand? Nothing. Just give me some more brakes.
It's funny, you've driven quite a few race cars, as I thought. And when everyone goes, what's the best thing about a race car? Every time, brakes. Because you come into a corner. I remember the first time I had a driver coach and we were at Donington. And I'd done a lap, and my driver coach, he said, "Are you expecting a refund on brake pads?" I'm like, "What do you mean?" He went, "You're not braking." I went, "Yeah." I am. He went, no, you're not. He said, "You're either on the throttle or you're on the brake."
Yeah.
And when you're on the brake, you're on the brake.
Yes. You know?
And if you're not braking hard, then you're braking too early.
Yes.
So just brake.
Yeah. It's
like, amazing.
But it's so true. I think that's one thing about track driving. Anyone that's asked me about stuff for the first time, whatever, or they're coming out for a passenger lap for the first time, what's it, you know, am I going to be scared? Well, acceleration, unless it's really, really fast, probably not, because you probably have experienced that kind of acceleration in this car or another car on the road, because that's not unusual for us, is it? No. If you're a spirited driver on the road, you feel that all the time, foot on the floor. That is not any quicker on track. In fact, it feels slower sometimes because you're in a much safer environment, and places like Silverstone actually feels even slower again because it's so big, right? Yep. But the first thing that you really notice, and even as someone like both of us that drive a lot on track, the first thing you have to get your head around, your first track day in a while, is hitting that brake pedal hard and getting around, supporting yourself with the wheel and just understanding. Because you don't do that on the road unless you have to stop for something in an emergency.
Yeah.
You're not braking on that ever on the road. So it's...
I mean, Pat and I, when we were at the ring last year, we went round in that 992 GT3.
Yeah.
And that we were pulling nearly 2G on the brakes on standard road tyres.
Yeah.
So you come into a corner, you'd be like, I'll be on the brakes by now.
Yeah.
No, I'll be on the brakes by now. Break!
Yeah.
So that's break. So the last thing to talk about, there's two more things to do, we've got plenty of time, look, is making a car go faster.
Yes.
So now I'm going to preface this by saying I am not an expert at all in this area, but I kind of, you know enough. I want to talk at the different stages.
Yes.
But I think it's the one of the reasons I want to do this, because for me, different stages depends on the tuning house you're talking to as what the definition of a stage is.
Yeah.
So if we talk about something like stage one.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is, you want to make your car go faster. And we're talking, for me, I'm talking more modern cars with computer controlled ECUs.
Yeah.
So what a stage one would do, and I'm going to put my definition and see if you agree, right?
Yeah. Don't look at me for advice.
So stage one for me, there is a minimal amount of hardware updates. So stage one would normally be a new set of spark plugs and a different panel filter probably, or a different air filter. But then most of it is ECU tuning.
Yeah.
So you change the map in the engine to increase the power and torque that the engine produces.
Yep.
And as stage one, you can normally get a healthy amount of extra oomph.
Yep.
You know, you might take a 200 horsepower car up to 220 or 230 or 400 horsepower car up to 450, something like that.
Yeah, I think
10-15%.
If it's NA, then very minimal.
Yeah.
If it's a turbocharge, which a lot of modern things are, then you can get a noticeable gain. And I think in most cases, don't quote me on this, but in most cases, pretty safe as well. Yeah. Like that 10% gain.
Yeah,
you're well within the
spec of the engine.
Yeah.
But the bit that I think is important to add, and I only know this having worked with Mulgari on my Mini, is it's not about the number.
No.
So it's not about what the BHP figure you end up with or the torque number you end up with. It's about how you get there and what that, when you look at power and torque curves and when you start doing tuning, you end up being really nerdy and understanding. It's about how it comes in.
Yep.
So I think a stage one, if you go to someone who really knows the manufacturer of car, whatever you've got, the really good guys won't be that bothered about the number. They'll want is the drivability of the car.
Mm-hmm.
But you can pep up a car. And the nice thing about stage ones, they're not going to be ridiculous amounts of money. My gut feel says £400 or £500 will probably get you a stage one tune for most cars.
Yep.
I don't know.
Yep.
I'm thinking in my head, Minis and I don't know.
And BMs,
that kind of money. So, and I think for most people, that might be, they've got their car, they want it to be a little bit quicker, a bit more responsive. And I think a stage one is a simple place to go.
Yep.
It's low risk to the engine. It's not that expensive. And I think if you're not sure about whether you're going to like modifying a car, a stage one's a great place to go, because worst case scenario, you can just put it back to standard if you don't like it.
Yeah.
Without having spent loads of money.
Yes. Yeah. And there are companies, although this is, again, a bit of a sketchy way of doing it, but there are good ones and there are bad ones. Again, relating to how much development's gone into these, like you said about the torque and the power curve,
yeah,
there are some plug-in ones you can get. I think like JB Plus, I know a number of people that use JB Pluses on B58 cars, and you plug them in somewhere. I think it's do you plug them in the OBD port or somewhere under the engine in a port somewhere? But it's literally a case of pretty much plug in and go.
Yeah.
And that gives you instantly about 10-15% more, and it really unlocks that engine. But yeah, I think if you're doing it properly, you take it down to someone like well, I know Imran at Evolve, or you know, various other places.
Go somewhere. And my top, if wherever you go, if they don't do some basic health checks on your engine before they start tuning it,
yeah,
drive out there and just run for the hills, because you need to. And if you maybe, I don't know, at stage one, but certainly when I did my stage two on my Mini, we did like half a day of pressure tests and all kinds of things to make sure that the engine was a good one.
Yeah.
And you know, it's been recently serviced and all those types of things. So you do your basic beforehand.
Yeah.
Stage two. So what have you got you on the M2? You've got stage two.
I don't know. I'm going to put my hands up here.
So
now.
Stage two.
I don't even know. I hear these people talking about, hey, stage two, you know. And it's like, I've got stage 17, two, you know. It? Yeah. It's like, I've got 1,000 horsepower, innit? I don't even know what this is.
So stage two, so a bit more hardware for me, I think. So stage two, I'm in mini land now. Okay. I don't know whether it's, I'm sure it's the same.
Yeah.
So normally you'd have a bigger intercooler.
Yes.
So you increase the cooling capability, so you get better charge temperatures and all that kind of stuff. And then you would also, for stage two, I think, change the catalytic converter and have a higher flow cat.
Yep.
So my car's got a 100-cell Akrapovic cat and a bigger intercooler.
Yep.
Different plugs, different panel filter, different ECU stage.
Yep. Obviously, remove things like OPFs and stuff.
Well, my car didn't have an OPF, that's a good question.
Good modern stuff.
So that, you know, my car went from 211 brake to 270.
Yeah.
From 250 newton meters to about 400. So it's
amazing.
You know, big chunk of increase.
Yeah.
But even that stage two is still within the capacity of the engine. You were talking about how engines can take a lot more.
Yeah.
And then you can kind of go from there. There's threes and fours, and then I don't know what the difference is.
Yeah,
I drove a Litchfield GTR once, which was stage 4.5. I don't know. It spanned all four wheels.
Wow.
Going down a slip road on a motorway.
Yeah.
So you've got that. You can basically push it as much as you like.
Yeah.
My advice, having been down that journey only once, is just start at one.
Yeah.
See if you like it, then go to two. If you go to two and you don't like it, then you've spent a lot of money on hardware and stuff. And I think you just want to step up a little bit.
And I think also, if you were just after speed, let's say you got your car and you're like, I've got an M140i and I just want it to go a little bit faster in a straight line, then stage one's all right. But if you go stage two without anything else and the other mods we talked about, brakes and forget it, like that's just, to me, that's idiotic.
So I went stage two.
Yeah,
and then on a standard clutch, open diff.
Yeah,
it was all right, bit hairy in the wet, and then I just started to feel that the clutch wasn't a happy bunny.
Yeah,
so I then went back and put a racing clutch and a limited slip diff, and then that nailed
sorted it. Yeah.
So there's those stages. Now the last bit to talk about is if you do any of the things that we've talked about so far. Any of them, apart from maybe some of the aesthetic changes, you need to tell your insurance company.
Yes.
Arguably, and this is arguably, even if you went from run flats to standard tires, I would still tell my insurance company.
Yeah.
Because you have changed out the dealership specification of your car.
Yeah.
And just don't give your insurance company any excuse to be shitty with you if you have a big accident.
Yeah. Yeah, and that can cost. I've just had my renewal on my M2, which was already quite scary. But yeah, now it's my renewal is double, 17 years no claims or whatever. Anyway, There's that, but there's also one other thing that I'd like to talk about. I'm conscious.
No, I think this is a longer one.
Oh, okay, yeah. Is something I get asked about a lot is with my cars is how did you do that when it's financed or when it's new?
Yeah,
warranty or finance gray areas, and I say gray areas, they are gray areas. There's no, I never like to give any advice or encourage people to do something that
Joe Achilles said this.
it's always a case by case, and that's ever changing. Manufacturers like BMW are getting stricter and stricter with what you can't do on your new BM.
Ask Ricky.
Well, Ricky learned the hard way, although Ricky did know. I'm sure he was aware of it. But anything ECU related especially is a real no-go area. I'm talking BMWs especially. It's all remote now as well. So if you do anything ECU related, even down to things like unplugging the OPF filter, OPF sensor, if that wasn't done at a dealership and it was maybe potentially because you're putting a full exhaust system or something in there, that can be enough to black flag your entire warranty on your car for good. So if your car's a month old and it's 100,000 mile M3 and you've just changed the exhaust, you can get black flagged overnight and there's no going back. And that's everything. That's not black flagged on exhaust components. Mm. That's the whole car is now a black flag. So speak to your dealership and your salesperson that you got the car from. Discuss it with them. Let them be the people that give you the word. Don't always take my word for it. Over the years, have I played with fire a little bit? Yes, probably. Because if you go by the exact book, sometimes you can't get away with anything.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, BMW want to sell you some of their horrible end performance, overpriced garbage. So they're making it harder and harder for you to buy tasteful stuff, aftermarket tasteful stuff. I say some of it's all right, but God, it's awful.
Just say what you mean, mate.
Yeah, sorry.
Don't hold back. It's a conversation that, I mean, the two examples I'll give. So one of the first things we said about was noise.
Yeah.
So a modern day car has OPF filters and restrictions that mean that they don't sound like they used to back 5 years ago.
Yep.
10 years ago. Pre 2018.
Yep.
So you could put a new exhaust on, but if you keep the OPF filter and just go OPF back, which is what I did on my Mini Clubman.
Yep.
You don't get any engine warning lights.
No.
The engine's super happy because it's got its OPF and its catalytic converter and everything.
Yep.
And all you're really doing is changing the noise that comes out the back box.
Yep.
And when I did that, I spoke to my local Mini dealer and said, what's your thoughts on that? And they went, we haven't got one really, because it's just, you're not really, it's OPF back.
Yeah.
But I kept the bits I took off the car.
Yep.
So that when I traded it back in or sold the car, I could return it back to stock.
Yep.
Okay. So that's why you've got a storage unit and I've got a shed.
Yeah.
Because it's full of bits.
Yes.
I've got my Porsche exhaust in my shed.
Yeah.
So that's fair enough. Technically, if you read your finance agreement, you're not meant to do that.
Yep.
But if you've got the bits and you can turn it back, then that's the gray area.
Yep.
Then I did a thing with my Porsche with Zonsport grills on the front of my Porsche, which I put some grills on the front of my car to protect the open radiators that Porsche had failed to protect.
Yep.
By not putting grills on the front, because they only put grills on their GT cars.
Failed to on purpose, yeah.
Yeah. And then I put a video out and people going, oh no, I got my warranty invalidated from my Porsche center because I had grills on the front. You're like, wow.
Yep.
I believe that's a Porsche center by Porsche center conversation to have.
Yep.
So it's a difficult area. But the takeaway, whether it's warranty issues or whether it's insurance, is be open and honest with your local dealership and with your insurer.
Yeah.
Because if you're not, then I heard recently of someone, a friend of a friend, who wrote the car off, had a big accident, smashed the car up.
Yeah.
They were given a replacement quote by the insurance saying, right, this is the payout. And they said, no, I'm not happy with that. It's not because it wasn't enough.
Mm.
So the insurance company says, well, we'll send someone out to inspect the car.
Yeah.
Sent them out to inspect the car. It was stage 2 tuned. They hadn't told the insurance company.
Oh.
And the insurance company went, well, we're not giving you anything.
Oh. Yeah, and they got no leg to stand on at that point. That's it. Game over. But, yeah.
Wish he'd take the first offer. But,
yes.
But that in a serious note, that
deal or no deal.
You know, that and you know, some insurance companies are super relaxed about it. ECU tune's definitely a big thing, but you know, wheels, tires, they might not worry about. Some will. Yep. Some will worry about aesthetics, some won't. You know. Yep. So just the best thing is to do is just tell them.
Yeah.
And there's the best conversation, you ring your insurance company up and say, oh no, I've just changed the exhaust on my car. And the insurance company says, and? We don't care.
Yes.
Great.
Yeah.
But you've told them.
Yeah.
You know, that you don't tell them, you have an accident and they come out and go, you've changed the exhaust on your car. You hadn't told us.
Yeah.
Now, do we pay out the, you know, you've hit a £50,000, you know, brand new car. Do we pay out £70,000 for your car and that car? Or do we not pay out because you've not told us about it?
Yep.
So... Totally. Always don't, even the things that you can't see.
Yep.
Even a stage one. You have an accident and kill somebody.
Yep.
Or crash into a Rolls-Royce Cullinan at Goodwood because it's doing its test drive.
Yeah.
And the insurance payout's going to be over $100,000. Your insurance company will be over you like a rash.
But at least the Rolls would look better.
Ah. Oh. Should I check my list, mate, just to see before we upset? You've upset BMW, you've upset... I think that's it. I think we've done it, mate.
Yeah, we covered it.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Oh, I enjoyed that one.
That was good.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting subject. It's been lovely. I really enjoyed this location as well.
Ben, again, thank you. Yeah, he's just sat over there doing some work now because we took him... out for the whole morning with this morning's podcast.
I think he's pretending to do some work.
Yeah, he's on auto trader.
Yeah. He can't wait for the other episode to go live.
Exactly.
He's literally like, is it live yet?
Yeah, exactly.
But no, it's awesome down here. And yeah, like we said in the last one, check him out on Instagram. There'll be a link below in the description.
And also, make sure you subscribe if you're watching on YouTube. Give us a rating and follow us on the podcast platform. And if you are coming next week, we shall see you. If you want to come, click on the link below. Hopefully there'll be some tickets there. If not, we will be doing plenty of others.
Yep.
If you've got an amazing venue anywhere in the UK, you want us to come and do a live podcast in your dealership or coffee shop or whatever it is, reach out to us. We're up for venues.
Definitely.
Especially up north, because we kind of tend to do lots of stuff down south, but we've got followers everywhere.
Yeah, I'd love to go up north. Yeah. We need to do an on the road trip. Like a week on the road.
Exactly. Exactly.
That'd be cool. Yeah.
Anyway, good on you.
Cool.
That was a good one, that.
Yeah.
Cool.
Nice.
We shall see you on the next episode. Let us know your modification stories as well. Because I bet there's a few out there. Have you over modified and then demodified a car? Because I have.
Yeah. And me.
Take care, guys. Cheers.
Cheers.